Direct your attention to Matthew 26. Matthew 26. We looked at Christ's prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane, and then we looked specifically last week at verses 47 through 56 of Matthew 26, where Christ was arrested, betrayed by Judas, and arrested. We said that with the words that are used not only here in Matthew but in other gospel accounts, upwards to 800 people came to arrest Christ. There was a cohort of Roman soldiers, which is 600 soldiers. And then there were the temple police officers, which could have been a couple of dozen at least. And then there was the Sanhedrin, which is made up of 70 men. Whether they were all there or not, we don't know. But it was pushing upwards to 800 people that came to arrest Christ. And they did lay hold on him after Judas had kissed him and betrayed him with that kiss. So we begin this evening with verse 57 of Matthew 26. We enter now into the trial, or I should say trials, plural, of Christ. And that takes us on into even chapter 27 as we see these trials. And I say trials because remember there was the Jewish government and there was the Roman government. The Roman government, the Roman Empire, did give a certain amount of self-rule to Israel, and yet it was limited. And so Christ was tried both in the Jewish courts as well as the Roman courts. And in each one of these courts, there were really three phases. With reference to the Jewish court, he was taken to Annas first. He was the former high priest, who was sometimes continued to be referred to as the high priest, but his son-in-law, Caiaphas, was actually the high priest at this time. But when they first arrested Christ, they took him to Annas. Then Annas sent him on to Caiaphas, and then the Sanhedrin gathered together at the court of the high priest, Caiaphas, and they tried him, and then when morning came, the Sanhedrin came back together for basically a finalization of the trial. And so there was, Christ was before Annas, he is before Caius and the Sanhedrin, and then a second time later on in the morning before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. But after that morning trial, if you want to call it that, the Sanhedrin sent him over to Pilate. Now we enter into the Roman phase of his trial. Pilate questioned Jesus. When he found out that Jesus was from Galilee, he sent him to Herod. Herod, the tetrarch, was in charge of the Galilean area at that time. He happened to be in Jerusalem for the Passover. And so when Pilate found out that Christ was a Galilean, he sends him over to Herod. Herod questions Christ. Christ sends him back, or Herod sends him back to Pilate. So he meets with Pilate, he goes to Herod, and then back to Pilate, and then it's at that time where Pilate declares him innocent, but allows them to crucify him anyway. So that's kind of the sequence of events. Annas, Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin, and then a second time before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin, then before Pilate, and then before Herod, and then a second time before Pilate. Just to kind of keep that in mind as we go down through this. In verse 57, Matthew doesn't record that he was taken to Annas first. Matthew just goes ahead and records that he was taken to Caiaphas. It says, and they that had laid hold on Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. So again, Matthew does not include the time that Christ stands before Annas. He just starts with Caiaphas, and it refers here to the scribes and the elders. That is the Sanhedrin. The scribes and the elders is the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin, as I've said many times, was the self-rule that the Romans allowed Israel or the Jewish people to have. And the Sanhedrin were the religious leaders, but they were also the court of law. It was made up of 70 men, 70 religious leaders. The high priest made it 71. So it was 70 men, religious leaders, but then the high priest was part of that that made it actually 71. It was an odd number so that there could never be a tie as far as in any kind of deliberations. The high priest would be the one who would break that tie if there was a tie. He was the 71st person. A little bit of history that I think helps explain some of this. Let me read. You don't need to turn to it, but let me just read from Deuteronomy 16. This is just a general statement about how God wanted Israel to be just and fair and how to go about it. It's not real detailed, but it's from Deuteronomy as it relates to justice and fairness. Deuteronomy 16, verses 18 through 20. You shall appoint for yourself judges and officers in all your towns which the Lord your God is giving you, according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not distort justice, you shall not be partial, and you shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. Justice and only justice you shall pursue, that you may live and possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you. So he says, in every town you appoint judges and officers, and it needs to be done with justice, it needs to be done without partiality, it needs to be done without bribery. Again, just some general thoughts that God gave to Israel as it relates to judgment. How that played out then in history. Basically, if there was a community or a village of 120 men who were heads of households, up to 120, if your town was that big, then you could establish a court of law. This, it says here in Deuteronomy, you shall appoint for yourself judges and officers. If there was a community of 120 men who were heads of households, then that was big enough for you to appoint these judges in your community. It was usually the court that was made up was usually made up of the religious leaders of the synagogue in that community. And this court was referred to as the Sanhedrin. But then in Jerusalem, you had basically what we would consider the federal court, the Supreme Court, and that was the Great Sanhedrin. Usually we simply refer to it as the Sanhedrin. That's then this 70 men, with the high priest being the 71st. We refer to it as the Sanhedrin. It was really the Great Sanhedrin, and each little community had their own little Sanhedrin, but it was just their court of law. There were some requirements that developed over the years, and amazingly, and I know I'm getting a little sidetracked here, but I think it's important for us to see this as we go through the trial of Christ, because it becomes very, very obvious very, very quickly that almost everything they did was illegal. Not just by our standards today, but by their standards at that time, because much of what we have in our country today is taken directly from the Old Testament and the Jewish courts of law. Much of what we have as jurisprudence in our own country today is taken directly from that. And that's why we often refer to it as the Judeo-Christian setup that we have in our own country, because much of it was taken from the Jewish people. And so let me just relate some of the things that did develop. Not all of this is specifically spelled out in detail in the Old Testament. It was more general in the Old Testament, but this is what the Jewish people came up with, and it became their law. First of all, there was a requirement that guaranteed an accused criminal that he had a right to a public trial. A public trial. You could not try somebody in secret. You could not try somebody out of the public's eye. It had to be, by law, a public trial open to public scrutiny. We have that today. That was one of their laws. And again, as we go through this, think about the trial of Christ, what you do know about it. Right here in verse 58. But Peter followed him afar off onto the high priest's court and went in and sat with the guards to see the end. Now, when he says the high priest's court, he was out in the courtyard. He was not actually inside where the proceedings were taking place. He wasn't allowed in there. Nobody was allowed in there. The trial of Christ was being done in secret. By law, Peter should have been able to go into the proceedings. By law, the guards could have been gone into the proceedings. But he was kept out in the courtyard. And so right there we have one of the illegalities of the trial of Christ. So one of the laws was it had to be a public trial, open to public scrutiny. Secondly, obviously, the defendant had a right to counsel. We recognize that today. You know, if you watch television, you hear people being given the Miranda rights. And what's the Miranda rights? You have a right to a lawyer. And if you ask for a lawyer, they can't question you anymore beyond that, because you have a right to a lawyer before you even questioned. Well, that's not something that the United States came up with. That was part of Jewish law. You had a right to counsel as the defendant. Was Jesus given that right? It wasn't at all. Conviction could only be at the testimony of at least two reliable witnesses. One witness wasn't enough. It had to be at least two reliable witnesses. And it's interesting. Again, you don't need to turn to it, but as it relates to the witnesses, here's something that we as a nation haven't established and probably should. Reading from Deuteronomy chapter 19, beginning with verse 16. If a false witness rise up against any man to testify against him that which is wrong, then both the men between whom the controversy is shall stand before the Lord, before the priest and the judges who shall be in those days. And the judges shall make diligent inquiry. And behold, if the witness be a false witness, and has testified falsely against his brother, then shall you do unto him as he had thought to have done unto his brother. So shall you put the evil away from among you. You understand what it's saying? If you're a false witness, and you're found out to be a false witness, then the penalty that would have gone to the defendant if found guilty goes to you. In other words, if it's in a capital offense, if you're a false witness in a capital offense and you're found out to be a false witness, you, as the false witness, are put to death. Because in your false witness, you were trying to put this person to death, but you were found out to be false, and so you're going to be put to death. Whatever penalty would have come to one if they had been found guilty because of your false witness, that's the penalty that you would receive. We don't do that in our country. Maybe we should. Just a thought. In Jewish law, that is what happened. So it had to be two reliable witnesses, and if they were found to be false, they'd be the punishment would come to them. By law, it required that a sentence of death could not be carried out until the third day after it was rendered, and that during the intervening day, the members of the court were to fast. So in other words, if you found somebody guilty today, then as members of the court, you had to fast the rest of today, all day tomorrow, and then on Friday is when the execution would be carried out. But you had to wait until then. And during that intervening time, as part of the court, you had to fast. And during that fast, you had to evaluate the whole court proceedings. And then on that third day, after you had fasted, you would be brought back together and to see if anybody changed their mind. If during that intervening period of time you thought differently, then you could change your mind and you would re-vote. Interestingly, if the person had been found guilty, but then after fasting and after that wait, you changed your mind and now the person is not found guilty, then the person would be set free. You could go from guilt to acquittal, but you could not go the other direction. If you acquitted the person today, on Friday, you couldn't come back and find them guilty. We practice that to a certain extent today in the sense that you can't try somebody a second time. If they are acquitted in a fair trial, you can't try them a second time. And that's kind of what the Jewish law read as well. Again, obviously, with reference to the trial of Christ, as you think that through, he was found guilty and crucified on the same day. There was to be that intervening period that they ignored completely with reference to Christ. On the first day of the trial, all evidence against the accused person was to be read in full hearing of the court. Read down through here. Again, on the first day, all the evidence had already been gathered. All the witnesses, everything has already been gathered, and all the evidence was to be read before the open court on the very first day. And then you'd proceed with the trial, but you had to present all the facts on that first day. All the evidence that you had was to be presented on that first day. But notice here, it says Peter followed him afar off in the high priest's court and went in and sat with the guards and to see the end. Now the chief priest and the elders, that is the Sanhedrin, all the council, sought false witness against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Here's the first day of the trial. They're to be reading all of the evidence that's already been gathered. They haven't gathered any evidence. They have nothing. Now they're trying to drum up some false witnesses. That's entirely illegal. They were to have all of the evidence before they even convened. But here they're convening and now trying to find the evidence. Witnesses in the court of law had to identify the precise month, day, hour, and location of the event by which they were testifying. They had to identify the month, day, hour, and location of what they were talking about. But we see in these false witnesses, they try to find some false witnesses against Jesus. They found none. Though many false witnesses came, yet found they none. At the last came two false witnesses. In other words, they tried to find some false witnesses. They found some false witnesses, but these false witnesses could not get their story right. In other words, the witnesses were contradicting each other. They weren't finding anything by which they could convict Christ, is what these verses are saying. The false witnesses were coming, and again, you don't need to turn to it, but in Mark's record of it says, for many bore false witness against him, but their witness agreed not together. So they had the false witnesses, but as Matthew says, they couldn't really find anything against Christ because the false witnesses didn't even agree. The council itself, another one of the laws, the council itself could not initiate charges against a person. In other words, someone else had to bring the charge and then the Sanhedrin would hear the case. Here we have the Sanhedrin bringing the charge, or at least trying to bring a charge against him. Of course, the presumption of innocence, again, we may think that that's something that, you know, we great Americans came up with. It's not at all. You're innocent until proven guilty. That's not just the United States court of law. That was Jewish law. You were innocent until proven guilty. and it was the presumption of innocence. In fact, and this is a quote, one of the governing principles in capital cases, that is when the death penalty was possible, one of the governing principles, here's the quote, the Sanhedrin is to save, not destroy life. In other words, not that they were against capital punishment, but they had to do everything they possibly could to try to prove the innocence in order to save the life, rather than prove the guilt in order to destroy the life. Now, if the evidence was overwhelmingly against, and then yes, capital punishment was possible, but that was not the goal. The goal of the Sanhedrin was to save the life, not to destroy it. The goal of the Sanhedrin was to do everything they could to try to find the man innocent rather than guilty. But what do we read here? In verse 59 again, the Sanhedrin gathered together and they sought false witnesses against Christ to put him to death. That was their goal, to put him to death against the law. Then let me read this. I'm going to go ahead and read this several sentences, but it's very fascinating, I found. If a guilty verdict was reaffirmed, that is, you know, on that third day, they would come back together and, you know, after fasting, did they still think the individual was guilty? And if so, if they reaffirmed the guilt, here's what would take place. If a guilty verdict was reaffirmed, an officer with a flag remained near the council while another officer, often mounted on horseback, escorted the prisoner to the place of execution. A herald went before the slow-moving procession, declaring in a loud voice, "This man," and then they'd state the name, so in this case, "this man, Jesus, is led to punishment for such a crime. The witnesses who have sworn against him are," and then the names of the witnesses would be listed. "If anyone has evidence to give in his favor, let him come forth quickly." So they'd proceed through the city, declaring, "This man has been found guilty. Here are the witnesses against him. But if you have any information that will help this individual, come forth now." And that would be heralded throughout the city. If at any time before the sentence was carried out, additional information pertaining to innocence came to light, including the prisoner's recollection of something he had forgotten, one officer would signal the other, and the prisoner would be brought back to the council for reconsideration of the verdict. No criminal trial could be begun during or continued into the night. Is one of their laws. You could not start a trial at nighttime, or if it did start during the day, it could not continue into the night. It had to stop before night came. The property of an executed criminal could not be confiscated, but was to be given to his heirs. What did they do with the garment of Christ? They cast lots and gave it to the one who won in that. So, again, there I just read off about a dozen different laws, every one of which were broken during these trials of Christ by the, and this is just the Jewish side of it, not the Roman side. Do you have any thoughts or questions about that as we go through that? I just thought that was fascinating to read that. That's another area where they broke the law there as well. And that, I was doing some reading on that today, and some have tried to use that and say, well, see, apparently it wasn't a legal matter. No, it's just they were being illegal then too.
Could the Sanhedrin have stoned Christ?
No. No, the Sanhedrin could not, and that's, again, probably in the case of Stephen, the Romans overlooked that capital punishment in order to just, you know, understand that Pilate, Herod, those Roman rulers, their biggest fear was unrest. because if unrest took place, they would probably be out of a job. Rome, Caesar, all he cared about was that there was rest and peace in his empire. And if you, as Pilate down there in Israel, couldn't keep the peace, if there was continual unrest, you would lose your job. That's all they cared about. And so there were times when these, like Pilate or Herod, these ones who were over certain areas, they didn't always keep the law themselves. They just wanted to keep peace. And if they could keep peace by breaking the law, that was okay. And so probably like in the case of Stephen, they stoned him to death. It was illegal. They shouldn't have done it. But to raise a fuss about it would have caused unrest. And so they just hushed it. Ultimately, again, Acts chapter 2, in the sermon on the day of Pentecost, Peter says, by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, by wicked hands you have crucified him. And I point that out all the time. Yes, it was by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, but it was still wicked hands that did it. They were still responsible for their sin and for their wickedness and for their evil, even though it was by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God. So now, in the case of Christ, like with Stephen, they just went out and stoned him. Christ was too popular for them to do that. That's why they did this all in secret, and then they had a plan, and they took it to the Romans. The Jewish people were not going to go against the Romans, so that's what the Sanhedrin here, they're trying to do everything they can to find something by which he'd be guilty of death so that they could then take it to the Romans because they could not carry out a sentence of death. So they tried to find something that the Romans would agree to that they'll put him to death so that the Romans were the ones doing it, not the Sanhedrin. They were doing that to protect themselves from the multitude, from the crowd. They knew that the crowd would not go against the Romans, but they might go against the Sanhedrin. He was so popular. I'm sorry, we're out of time and we haven't really gotten to the scriptures, but again, I thought that it was very significant to go through this. We'll pick up from there next week the search for the false witnesses and then what the false witnesses said and why all of a sudden they thought that they had them. Because of what these false witnesses said, they felt that, okay, now we have something that we can take to the Romans. The Sanhedrin, they said he was blaspheming. Now, from their perspective, he was. He was claiming to be God. That, if any of you here tonight claim to be God, I would call that blasphemy. And so from their perspective, Jesus was blaspheming because he claimed to be God. Now, we know that he is God, so it wasn't blasphemy. So the Sanhedrin said he's blaspheming, he's guilty of death. And according to the Old Testament, that was true. Blasphemy was punishable by death. But the Sanhedrin knew that the Romans could care less that he was blaspheming. They couldn't go to the Romans and say, well, he's blaspheming, and expect the Romans to put him to death. That wasn't going to happen. So they had to come up with something else. And we'll see what they thought they had on him that they could take to the Romans. Let's bow in prayer. Father, we thank you so much again for your Son. It was indeed by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of you. You had it all planned. This was how you were going to redeem man. We thank you for your love. And yet, Father, we recognize that it is by wicked hands that he was crucified. And it is certainly our wickedness and our sin which necessitated his death, so that our sin would be punished and that we might be saved through faith in him. Thank you so much, Father, for your forgiveness because of the blood of Christ. It's in his name we pray. Amen. Good evening. Thanks for coming.